cord just turns it on, but if I want
Good afternoon and welcome to the March meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum, coming to you today from Erickson Hall at Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. The welcome as well to our public radio audience. I am Tom DeMarco, a member of the board of the Mid-Coast Forum, and the forum, in case you don't know about it, is an organization founded in 1983 by a group of retired Foreign Service, intelligence, and military personnel to study foreign relations and to make a presence of foreign relations and foreign relations analysis, particularly U.S. foreign policy analysis, in the Mid-Coast area. More about that at our website, midcoastforum.org, but let me give you the short topic. Our topic is our topic is always foreign relations, and it always comes with a perspective. The perspective today is Syria. And our guest this afternoon is Dr. Murhaf Juajadi, a Syrian-born specialist in Middle East affairs, and particularly Syrian affairs. And he is a professor just now at the Middle East Institute, Middle East Studies Institute at the National Defense University. He's also an adjunct professor at George Washington University and a longtime scholar, adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Murhaf is a second-generation diplomat. His father was part of the founding at the time of Syrian independence in 46, the time that the French actually left. He was part of the founding of the Syrian Foreign Service and subsequently served as ambassador to Spain, and eventually to the United Nations, where he was the principal delegate of Syria and became an ambassador to Syria, or Syria's ambassador to the United States later on. Murhaf has the characteristics which you're about to learn of being singularly well-informed, elegantly articulate, and beholden to absolutely no one, and therefore able to speak quite candidly. And the result of that is he has become the go-to guy for an informed opinion on the subject of the Middle East or anything having to do with Syria. That's why you may have seen him opposite Jim Lehrer or Gwen Ifill on the NewsHour or on Al Jazeera, ABC News, Nightline, CNN, BBC, and other broadcast media. Please welcome join me in welcoming Murhaf Juajadi.
Thank you very much, Tom. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I am truly very honored to be your speaker today. This is not the first time. This is my third time in Maine to speak on issues of the Middle East, and in this particular instance, Syria. I've made many friends here. I am astounded by how much you know, and it is terrific because it makes my job much easier. I propose to give you a summary of one of the latest chapters I have written. It's published in a book called Europe and the Middle East. It's published in Germany. My chapter is about Syria, whether it is a spoiler, as some argue, or whether it is a stabilizer in the Middle East, as others would argue. But beforehand, before giving you this, seems to be really a schizophrenic personality of Syria, let me talk a bit about recent domestic events in Syria, namely the economy, because I've been asked a lot of questions before this presentation, to talk a bit about the economy, about where Syria is going. As you know, Syria had been, for the past four decades, a centrally planned economy. It was a socialist republic where, again, the government was the engine of the economy and of growth. As of the year 2000, things have changed, and in some instances dramatically. And here, from time to time, we do get a few articles in the American media, but really very few. That is unfortunate. We have much more in the European media about the openness of the Syrian economy. When Bashar al-Assad came to power in the year 2000, he had decided to move away from a centrally planned economy to what he calls a social market economy. Here the key word, of course, is market. It's a market economy. He uses the word social in order to send the message that he is not going to be sending the lower social classes to fend for themselves, that he is not going to let go of subsidies immediately, but gradually, that he will continue to have a basket for the least fortunate in Syrian society to be able to fall into. But since then, what is remarkable about the changes in the Syrian economy is that it has been done by Syria with no assistance from anywhere else, unlike, for example, Eastern European states that later entered into the EU and who had massive funding from the EU in order for them to make the difficult transition. Here, Syria made it on its own. Syria now, for example, has several private universities. This was unheard of in the 1990s. Syria has private banks. Syria has private foreign banks. Syria now has private insurance companies. And Syria has recently established a stock market. Syria is opening up rather quickly. It is trying to encourage foreign investment. And in view of doing this, it has and continues to reform its tax system. For example, taxes have dropped from 65% to 20% in order to encourage people to declare their incomes and in order to make it a low enough rate that foreign companies would become interested in investing in Syria, which really needs now a huge overhaul of its infrastructure, an infrastructure that is now outdated and outmoded. So in Syria, there is a lot of excitement. There is the emergence of a new class of entrepreneurs. There is an emergence of the private sector that, although it continues to be behind the public sector, but is catching up very, very quickly. There is a new mindset now for the Syrian citizen. Rather than looking for government to do everything and to determine one's life, now people are taking economic matters into their own hands, and they are now repolishing that sense of Syrian creative entrepreneurship for which Syrians have been known for a very, very long time. Syria has cell phones. It has ATM machines. It has hôtel de charme in old cities like Damascus and Aleppo in the souk. And last year, Syria recorded its largest number of incoming tourists, over 3 million tourists, including many, many Americans. And Americans are encouraged to go to Syria. They get their visa from the Syrian embassy very easily and immediately. And a bit of good news, a travel advisory by the U.S. Department to Syria has been lifted a few days ago. So I encourage you all to make that trip, and it is a particularly interesting time now that Syria is making the transition. That said, Syria more often than not receives a lot of bad press in the US media. Syria is accused of a host of things. One major argument against Syria is that the Syrian regime claims it wants to have peace, and yet it equips Hezbollah. Yet it hosts Hamas. Yet it has an alliance with Iran. And so in such circumstances, a lot of people are question the validity of the claim that Syria wants peace. I am here to say that Syria does want peace. Syria wants peace not a la John Lennon. Syria does not want peace as a result of love thy neighbor and all that good stuff. Syria is acutely aware that it cannot move forward in the absence of peace. And in order for Syria to thrive, it needs to have peace and stability in the Middle East. And so therefore, Syria is ready and has been ready to recognize its arch rival in the Middle East, that is Israel. Syria's principal objective, principal foreign policy objective, is to recover its territory in the Golan Heights, a territory that has been occupied by Israel in 1967. And Syria uses all the means at its disposal in view of meeting that objective. Since the advent of the Assad regime in 1970, Syria's external behavior, Syria's external action has really been characterized by two seemingly mutually exclusive dynamics. And it is as a result of these mutually exclusive dynamics that there is a lot of confusion on what it is that makes Syria tick, what it is that Syria wants. On some occasions, for example, Syria has cooperated with the American order, with Pax Americana in the Middle East. At other times, Syria was at the forefront of those challenging that very same order. This is not inconsistent, and I will argue Syrian foreign policy is consistent. The tension between these contradictory modes of behavior, the tension that exists there is explained by Syria's determination to recover the Golan Heights. Syria is a stabilizing force when its leaders think that Syria's interests will be taken into account by diplomatic initiatives. What are Syria's interests? The recovery of the Golan Heights. Case in point, Syria had accepted the disengagement of forces with Israel that was initiated by Dr. Henry Kissinger, disagreement of forces that took place in 1974. This is an implicit recognition of Israel. 2 years earlier, Syria had recognized UN Land for Peace resolutions. Again, implicit recognition of Israel. Syria in 1975 intervened in Lebanon in large part to tame the Palestinian resistance movement there. And at the time, Henry Kissinger called Syria a force of stability in Lebanon. Syria sided with the US-led coalition against Iraq in the first Gulf War. And Syria sided with the United States. Its big criticism against Iraq and against Saddam Hussein is that he was doing with a fellow Arab state, Kuwait, what Israel had been doing, and that is invading and occupying territory. And therefore, Syria was on board with the United States and other coalition partners in order to liberate Kuwait. Syria was the first state to accept the US invitation to the Madrid conference. And it is as a result of Syria's acceptance that Israel accepted to go. And it is as a result of Syria's acceptance and the making of that conference, this had led to the Oslo talks between Palestinians and Israelis, and this has led to a peace treaty between Syria and Jordan. Syria cooperates with the United States, and it has shared intelligence with the CIA on, among others, Al-Qaeda. I said yesterday in a reception, and I will repeat again, Syria saved American lives by sharing intelligence with the CIA on an impending attack by Al-Qaeda against the administrative headquarters of the Fifth Fleet in the Bahrain. However, when Syrian interests are not taken into account, when there is a foreign diplomatic initiative that does not include the recovery of the Golan Heights by Syria, then you can be sure that Syria will act as a spoiler. And this is the only side that we see in the American media. I will give you examples of Syria intentionally sabotaging things. Syria, for example, mobilized the Arab world against Sadat's separate peace with Israel. Syria torpedoed the May 17 agreement between Israel and Lebanon, again out of fear that there would be separate agreements with Israel, leaving Syria behind. Syria acted as a challenger to U.S. regional hegemony by, for example, trying to destabilize Lebanon after February 2005, again out of fear that the Lebanese right wing would make a separate treaty with Israel and that Syria would be left behind. We heard a lot about the infiltration of jihadis into Iraq from Syria. We heard a lot about Syria hosting Hamas and Syria arming Hezbollah. Let me address these issues. Again, why destabilize Lebanon? Well, out of fear of a separate agreement with Israel. And this had been the case, and this had been the political engineering made in Washington under the Bush administration. A Bush administration that wanted and that was openly talking about a change of regime in Syria. Despite the fact that Syria equipped Hezbollah with weapons, Syria also showed that it can and is cooperative and can be a stabilizing factor. It had a very significant role in the Doha Agreement, which brought the Lebanese together, which enabled Lebanon to get a president, which enabled Lebanon to establish a government of national unity. And Syria went the extra mile. It not only recognized Lebanese sovereignty, but it has now established diplomatic relations with Lebanon, and Syria has an ambassador there, and Lebanon an ambassador in Syria. The infiltration of jihadis. You may recall, again, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, there were many calls in Washington to move westward, that is to Syria. Syria feared being invaded by American forces. And so Syria, I would say initially, facilitated the exportation of jihadis into Iraq. And here for two reasons. One, there are young Islamist fundamentalist crazies in Syria that wanted to commit suicide, and so Syria was happy to get rid of them. You want to go get killed? Go to Iraq. But two, it was to make life difficult for the United States in order for the United States to hesitate and not to change the regime in Syria by force. But in the process, it was shown that Syria began to cooperate with the United States in policing its border. It not only constructed a wall in an otherwise very porous border, it placed on that border 15,000 troops. In Damascus Airport, where Syria was accused of allowing in other Arab jihadists to go to Iraq, Syria would not allow young men in a certain tranche of an age between, I believe, 18 and something, who were bachelors and who went to Syria on a one-way ticket. Syria would repatriate them. Syria arrested over 2,000 jihadists that it repatriated to their home countries, and most of these were Saudis. But in the end, and this has been acknowledged by senior officers at CENTCOM, including General Odierno, that Syria is now doing a far better job in policing its border with Iraq. And that is because Syria and the United States share common interests in Iraq, and that is the stability and the unity of Iraq. Syria does not want to see an Iraq that is fragmented along ethnic and sectarian lines. On Iran, Syria is accused of being in bed with Iran. Well, the Syrian-Iranian alliance is the most enduring in the Middle East. And that is initially as a result of Syria's hatred, Hafez Assad's hatred for Saddam Hussein and his adventurous and murderous ways. And that alliance was formed early on in the Iran-Iraq war. But then it dissipated, and it reemerged only out of fear of the Bush administration. It is as a result of being pushed around by the Bush administration that Syria, which is a middle power, needed a patron. There was no Soviet Union. Where does Syria turn? And so it is unwittingly, I think, that the Bush administration is responsible for pushing Syria into Iranian arms. It is in order for Syria to create a balance of power against Israel that it has this alliance with Iran. I will contend that Syria, as other states, tries to advance its self-interests first. And I will contend that if the United States enacts the role of an honest mediator and broker between Syria and Israel, if Syria has the choice of recovering its Golan Heights or of continuing the alliance with Iran, that Syria is going to want to recover its Golan Heights. The alliance with Iran, I believe, is tactical. Now, when the State Department issues conditions for improving relations with Syria and tells Syria, break off your relations with Iran, and there is no enticement to do so, Syria is going to say no. What's in it for us? How can a foreign country dictate to us in Syria who our friends are going to be? And if you in Washington are going to use your weight with your ally, Israel, in order for us in Syria to recover our legitimate rights, which is the recovery of our land, Syria is not asking for the moon, it's asking to recover its land that has been illegally occupied, then there is no need for a strategic alliance between Syria and Iran. And so, in conclusion, I would say that Syria's external action is truly function of Washington and what it does, and of U.S. efforts to help Syria recover the Golan or not. When the U.S. actively pursues that goal, Syria has shown itself to be cooperative. Conversely, when Washington shuts Syria out, Damascus will do anything and everything to spoil any potential deal that does not include it. That is a rational actor at work. And what are the implications for the U.S. and for the international community? I think it has become high time for the United States to persuade Israel, which is the largest recipient of U.S. aid, which gets U.S. assistance to the tune of over $3 billion every year, to persuade Israel that it needs to sit down at the peace talks with Syria at a table, and in order for the Israelis and the Syrians to redo what they had been doing for a decade, and that is to talk peace, to talk land for peace. To those Israelis and pro-Israelis who say that Syria does not want peace, I can only take them back to Syria's acceptance of the Madrid conference invitation, of Syria's acknowledgement of Israel's security interests on the Golan, and in Shepherdstown, January 2000, when Syrians and Israelis negotiated for the last time that Syria had accepted Israel's three requirements for peace: normalization of relations, including the establishment of embassies and the free flow of people and goods and services, a water-sharing mechanism, and finally, a mutual security regime. A mutual security regime in which Israel can keep a presence in eavesdropping and monitoring stations that can see the movements of Syrian troops so that Syrian army would not, after peace, reinvade the Golan Heights. These were the requirements of Israel, and Syria accepted these requirements. The Syrian requirement of Israel was one, a withdrawal to the June 4th lines of 1967. And subsequently, at the time Prime Minister Ehud Barak gave Mr. Clinton, former President Clinton, the Israeli reply, which was an Israeli withdrawal on the Golan minus the shoreline of Lake Tiberias. He had reneged on his promise. He had reneged on the promise of the late Prime Minister Rabin. And in the end, and we have empirical evidence that is documented in books, that is documented in the memoirs of President Clinton, who said that at the last minute, Prime Minister Barak got cold feet. If anyone at the time torpedoed peace, it was not Syria, it was Israel. This issue is not only an academic issue. Peace between Syria and Israel is very necessary, and it is a prerequisite, I believe, to peace in the Middle East. Peace between Syria and Israel is easier to make than a Palestinian-Israeli peace, simply because the two peoples are not enmeshed with each other as much as the Palestinians and the Israelis are. And we have two states negotiating with each other. And we have a U.S. that recognizes that the Golan is Syrian and that does not recognize Israel's annexation of the Golan, as had been the case in 1981 when President Reagan declared that annexation as null and void under international law. If there is peace between Syria and Israel, I am of the view that there is no more need for Syria to rely on non-state actors to use as instruments of its power and instruments of leverage against Israel. A peace between Syria and Israel, I think, would enable the Palestinians and the Israelis for a deal with each other. In the end, most of the violence that is coming out of the Middle East, and oh boy, is there a lot of violence coming out of the Middle East, I think can be solved by a peace in the Middle East, one that is brokered by a U.S. that by necessity has to be an honest mediator between the two. The U.S. has responsibilities under international law. It has to ensure with others, those permanent members of the Security Council, international peace and stability. The Middle East can no longer afford to be drained and drain its resources and its energies in conflict. We have a set of recommendations by the United Nations as embodied in UN Resolution 242 that give us direction. We know what a final peace must look like. And so let us do it. We can no longer, we people of the world can no longer afford conflict management. We don't want to manage the conflict in the Middle East anymore. We want to resolve it. And I am hopeful that this administration is serious about trying to make peace in the Middle East. From day one, President Obama appointed Senator Mitchell as his envoy for Middle East peace talks. Now, President Obama has been derailed by major domestic issues, but I do think that he views the issue with a lot of seriousness, and he understands its gravity. But the United States, I think, has to go the extra mile. It can no longer tell Israel that its annexation of the Golan is null and void. The U.S. has to do something. The U.S. has leverage over Israel, and the U.S. must use it in order for the U.S. to not only make peace in the Middle East, that vital and strategic part of the world, but in view of advancing the U.S. national interest. I look forward for your questions for the discussion. Thank you.
Okay, usual deal. You need a microphone in your hand to address a question to Dr. Giugiati. Who have we got here? Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Giugiati, for that excellent overview. Let me ask you about one incident that is certainly on the minds of many Americans. The Israelis struck an installation in eastern Syria in which there's a considerable indication that it was a nuclear facility of some description, and the Syrians then erased all remains after the bombing had destroyed the facility. What's your explanation of what went on in that incident and what role the Syrian government had in mind for that installation?
This nuclear issue is a very, very serious one, and the danger, of course, is that there would be proliferation of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. Therefore, the big scare about Iran. Therefore, the scare about Syria, and you're right, Israel bombed a site, and that site was allegedly a nuclear site. After the bombing, the IAEA inspected it, and the IAEA does not look to be overly satisfied with the Syrian response of not allowing more inspections. But the Syrian position is this. The Syrian position is that the Middle East would be a far safer place if it were declared to be an area free of weapons of mass destruction and of nuclear weapons. And that should apply to all. It is extremely difficult to persuade Middle Easterners, especially Middle Easterners who are living there, that for some reason Iran cannot have atomic bombs when Israel has 200. And so I identify with the Syrian position and I identify with the Egyptian position. Let us destroy all weapons of mass destruction with all parties, including Syria and Israel and Iran. But if one state is allowed to have them and other states are not, something basically is wrong with that equation. And the party that shouts most about nukes in the Middle East, Israel, happens to be the only one that is not member of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. It is not member of the club, and then yet it wants to teach others lessons. I say the only solution to this, again, is to make, to declare the Middle East in its entirety an area free of weapons of mass destruction. I cannot answer you about the details of this site because I'm not a technician. I know that Syria has an arsenal of chemical warfare or has a chemical warfare ability. I know that Syria has a civilian nuclear program. I know there have been Syrian scientists that were trained in the United States. And I know that the civilian nuclear program in Syria produces isotopes. When I heard that this installation was bombed and it allegedly had a nuclear facility, I was startled because Syria is unable to provide electricity to all of its citizens. And Syria does not have the human resources in order to mount anything dangerous of that kind. But again, I may be wrong, there may have been other intentions there. But again, we have to attack the political aspect of this, and we have to render that Middle East weapons-free.
Questions?
I had a very brief visit at the Golan Heights a few years ago, and it was hard for me to understand how much area is involved. I know Syria would like to have what should be hers, but is it primarily because of the strategic location and the military advantage of being in those heights to attack Israel if they needed to, or to defend themselves?
No. It's a question of sovereignty. The Golan is Syrian territory. And on the Syrian territory, there are Syrian citizens that live and own property and have daily activities. And for another state to come in with an armed force and take that piece of property away, whether it's the Golan or the Jazeera or anywhere else in Syria, is, under Article 2 of the UN Charter, inadmissible. It is inadmissible by international law for a state to attack another. And this is what happened in 67. There are many Israelis and pro-Israelis that would argue that the Golan had been used as a jumping ground in order to attack Israel below, that the Golan is a strategic area. Well, I would ask them to read some of the memoirs of General Moshe Dayan, no other, who would say that most of the clashes that took place between Syria and Israel prior to 1967 were as a result of Israeli skullduggery. It is as a result of an Israeli settler movement, a settler movement that had pushed General David Elazar, at the time the chief of the Northern Command of the Israel Armed Forces, to push Moshe Dayan into attacking the Golan Heights. And if you don't want to read Moshe Dayan, read other Israeli generals, and read the United Nations Observer Forces, their records there, to show the creeping encroachment by Israeli settlers into the Golan, who would be shot at by Palestinian and Syrian farmers and settlers who would bring aboard the Israeli army in order to shell these positions that would then trigger Syrian fire. Syria doesn't want to recover the Golan Heights in order to attack Israel again. Syria wants to have peace with Israel and wants to recover its land. Again, Syria is not asking for the moon. It is asking for something that is very reasonable and very legitimate.
Questions?
Doctor, concerning the annexation of the Golan, which is a result of the 67 war, how do you see that in comparison to large swaths of Germany now being part of Poland as a result of the Allied countries redirecting or redistributing lands there? I know you're not an expert on European affairs, perhaps you are, but I'm not quite clear as to annexation as a result of an invasion into Israel.
Israel invaded the Golan Heights, and here parenthetically, between 1967 and 1968, the Israeli cabinet was of the view that the Golan should be returned to Syria in order to take Syria out of the Arab-Israeli conflict. This changed later on. Israel annexed the Golan Heights in 1981, meaning that it was going to implement Israeli law on the Golan, and it was going to provide people on the Golan with the Israeli citizenship. These people are Syrians under occupation, and they refused to get that Israeli citizenship. In the talks between Syria and Israel that have taken place already in that decade of the 90s, there was no question about swapping land or giving parcels of the Golan back or any deal that would look like what you are referring to between Germany and Poland. It has always been on the table and always been negotiated a land for peace settlement. Syria and Israel would then have normal relations like the relations between any two states in exchange for which Syrian land would return to Syria. There are ideas out there about the establishment of peace parks, in which the Israelis could visit parks in the Golan Heights and not require any Syrian visas, and that this Golan Heights would be still recovered by Syria and it would be under Syrian sovereignty. I don't know where these ideas will go. I don't know if they will be negotiated in the future between Syria and Israel. There has never been any flirtation about any ideas similar to ones that you are referring to. It has always been talked about and negotiated about the recovery of the Golan, the Israeli withdrawal from the Golan, in exchange for recognition and normal relations.
During the recent Camden conference, it was brought up that cultural exchanges between nations, in that case between Afghanistan and Pakistan and the United States, would be helpful. Is there any thought about cultural exchanges with Syria and the United States? Your culture and history go back thousands of years, and I understand that travel in Syria is now possible for Americans. What could we expect to find there if we do go, and what are you expecting? What might you send to us to let us know more about Syria?
Just a small correction here. Americans have always been welcome to Syria. It's not that Syria suddenly opened its doors to Americans, and there has always been the visit by American tourists and American trade delegations and American politicians and American academics to Syria. Cultural exchange is very, very good. This is the way you can understand the other. This is the way you can understand the values of the other. This is the way you can find common denominators. This is the way both in financial economic terms, both can take advantage of commercial opportunities. There is a lot to discover in Syria. Syria is an open-air museum. Syria's capital, Damascus, is the oldest inhabited city in the world. The street called Strait, which is mentioned in the Bible, stands today in Damascus as it had been then. The head of St. John the Baptist is buried in the Great Mosque of Damascus. One of the first churches in the world is outside of Damascus. 15 kilometers away from Damascus, they still speak Aramaic with the accent of Jesus Christ. This is truly the Holy Land. And it's not only in terms of religion, it is in terms of civilizations. The Greeks were in Syria, the Ottomans, before them the Seljuks, before the Romans, Crac des Chevaliers, that fortress that sits atop the Alawi Mountains overlooking the sea, is that castle that little kids in America on a beach try to build. And it is still standing the way it had been in the 1300s. The alphabet was discovered in Syria. The first music was discovered in Syria. And so, my God, it is such a rich nation in cultural terms, and Americans really ought to go to see what is there and to dispel these notions about a violent Syria, a rogue nation, and this and that. I, as an American citizen, when I land in Syria, I don't feel any fear, and I don't feel any fear of getting mugged, and I don't fear any of those fears that I could fear in New York City and what have you. You ought to go to Syria. And I myself, I was telling one of my friends here, I myself have conducted many tours of delegations of Americans wanting to go to Syria, and they have all come away very, very fascinated by that rich, rich country. You ought to go before it becomes very commercial and before there is a spread of fast food chains and so on.
Thank you. Your presentation is excellent. I am of the age where my memory doesn't work very well. And there might be a few others here of the same vintage. If I could ask you about the famous Six-Day War, where did Golan Heights fit into that, if it did?
In the Six-Day War, in the first few days of the war, the thrust of the Israeli attack was on the Sinai Peninsula, and the Israelis occupied the Sinai. And then the Israeli army moved to occupy the west bank of the Jordan River. And once that was complete, the Israeli army then proceeded to occupy the Golan Heights. Battles between the Syrians and the Israelis began on the 8th of June. This is 2 days after the beginning of the war. 3 days after the beginning of the war. And the Israelis continued their thrust despite the fact that the UN had declared a ceasefire that the Israelis had agreed to. But nonetheless, the ceasefire, which was to take effect on the 10th of June, did not, because the Israelis continued rolling into the Golan Heights, and they finally stopped when they took all the Golan Heights on the 11th of June. So the Golan Heights is part and parcel of, or the occupation of the Golan is the product of the 1967 war. I don't know if that answers your question. No. Now, you have perhaps not a good memory. I have a bad hearing, so you might want to ask the question again.
My memory is so bad that when I get up in the morning, go into the bathroom, I look in the mirror and ask, who's that? I'll ask my question again and maybe rephrase it. As I remember, and take that very carefully, as I remember, the Six-Day War started with Israel being attacked, not Israel attacking. So now, on that basis, where does the Golan Heights fit in?
I want to say there are two narratives. There is an Israeli narrative and there is an Arab narrative. But on the question of who started the 67 war, you shouldn't ask Israelis or Arabs. You should ask others who will tell you that Israel was the one to shoot the first shot. It is, for example, as a result of this that France had embargoed Israel. This was a condition of General Charles de Gaulle at the time. Whoever starts a war in the Middle East, there's going to be a French embargo. I think it is internationally recognized that the war of June 67 was started by Israel. You might tell me that there had been a whole lot of tension preceding the 67 war, and you'd be right. You might tell me that there had been a lot of Arab movement that got the Israelis nervous in 1967, and here I wouldn't disagree with you. But from the literature that I have read and from the interviews I have conducted with both Arabs and the Israelis, it is at least clear in my mind that Israel is the one to have started the war and to have occupied these territories and later on to have refused to withdraw from these territories with the exception of the Sinai Peninsula.
Thanks, Murhaf. Tell me what is going on in the Kurdish areas in Syria now.
One of the primary fears of Syria when the Bush administration went to war in Iraq was that the Kurds would get greater autonomy, which would whet the appetite of the Kurds in Syria. And this has been the case also in Turkey. The Turks were very, very nervous at this war for the same reasons. Obviously, with the Kurds now in semi-autonomy in the north of Iraq. Obviously, that has whet the expectations of Kurds, not only in Syria, but also in Turkey. And so as a consequence, I would say that Kurdish-Arab tensions in Syria are greater today than they had been in the past. Although the Syrian state is trying to assimilate the Kurds, there is still that nationalist feeling among the Kurds to create a state of their own, which is unacceptable to Syria. There has been also violent clashes between some Kurdish elements and the Syrian army. This is right after the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And that is caused by 200,000 Kurds in Syria who do not have Syrian citizenship. All in all, 10% of Syria's population is 20 million, 10% of these are Kurds. Of these 2 million, 200,000 do not have citizenship. And that is because these are Kurds from Turkey that had escaped Turkish violence in the 1960s and illegally crossed the border into Syria. Syria views them as illegal immigrants. Whereas the 1.8 million other Kurds are Syrian citizens and enjoy the civil rights of Syrian citizens. So, grosso modo, and in brief, Kurdish-Arab tensions in Syria are higher than they had been before the war in Iraq.
Time for one last question.
Thank you, sir, for all the broad portrayal of Syria, and love to go there. Been to the Golan Heights. It's a beautiful land to look off across towards Damascus. There's one subject that hasn't been covered, and that is the assassination of the president of Lebanon and the United Nations investigation, which seems to have been stonewalled. Could you bring us up to date on that?
Generally, it is alleged that Syria is behind the assassination of Prime Minister Hariri. Again, I am not privy to sensitive information. I cannot tell you one way or another if they are or they are not. Certainly, Mr. Hariri had many enemies. There was one allegation by Der Spiegel that those behind the assassination were Hezbollah, who has denied it. And there are others who have been accused. I don't know. And we're going to have to wait for that special tribunal. And I understand that its work has been progressing. It is noteworthy that four suspects, which had lingered in jail for, I think, 3 years, and these were the chiefs of Lebanese intelligence that had ties to Syrian intelligence, and these were suspected by the special tribunal on the Hariri assassination to have instigated it. It is noteworthy that they had been released by the court some time ago. The tribunal is taking a long time, but look, the tribunal in that African country. Is it the Burundi?
Rwanda.
Rwanda and Burundi. 10 years it has taken to establish that tribunal. So we have to be patient. We have to give it time. And I say that whoever the tribunal finds to be guilty should be taken to court and should be tried by a court of law, without any doubt, whether it is the Syrians or not the Syrians. But I myself do not know.
Has the Syrian government made available people who that the tribunal wanted to interview? My understanding is that that's been refused.
the Syrian government. That is simply not factually the case. The tribunal and delegations from the tribunal have visited Syria, and they have interviewed Syrian officials, and they have stayed in Syria, in Damascus, for a substantial amount of time in order to interview potential suspects. So Syria never closed the door before the tribunal.
Morhof, you had no idea how this would end, but it's going to end with the presentation of the highly coveted forum mug, which will make you a rock star in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all. You're wonderful. Thank you. Thank you very much.